Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Tides of History ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today. Hi, everybody from Wondery. Welcome to another episode of Tides of History. It is great to have you all here, and thanks for joining me. One of the best parts of studying the ancient world beyond the usual suspects, Greeks and Romans, for example, is that you quickly realize just how many other people there were inhabiting that world. Most of those societies, which were no less sophisticated or interesting than the ones that received top billing, have either been forgotten or overlooked. That's a shame for a lot of reasons, not least because everybody deserves to be remembered in some way, but also because it does a tremendous disservice to our understanding of that world and how it actually worked. The kinds of ancient societies that tend to get shunted to the side as bystanders tend to be rural rather than urban, indigenous rather than colonizing, non-literate, or without surviving writing rather than part of the classical corpus of texts. The Western Mediterranean of the Iron Age and early part of the classical period was full of societies like this, and one of the best investigated of them was on the island of Sardinia. Today's guest is an expert on those less renowned but no less fascinating societies and how all of them interacted with one another in the ancient Mediterranean. Peter van Domelen is Joukowsky Family Professor of Archaeology and Professor of Anthropology and Director of the Joukowsky Institute for Archaeology in the Ancient World at Brown University. He's carried out fieldwork on the island of Sardinia for decades and is the author and editor of numerous books, book chapters, and journal articles, most recently an edited volume entitled Rural Archaeologies. Professor van Domelen, thank you so much for joining me.
Well, thank you for having me. It's really a pleasure to join you here. So thank you.
So let's start at the very beginning. How did you get interested in archaeology in general and in the ancient Mediterranean and in Sardinia more specifically?
So that goes back decades as well, of course. Back home when I was growing up in the south of the Netherlands, the southwest of the Netherlands, just reading the ancient world was interesting. Then when I went to high school, which would have been the equivalent, middle school, got interested. I actually went to a school where Latin was taught from sort of well in the beginning of what the equivalent of middle school. And that got me interested. There's a really inspiring teacher as some familiar elements I think you might have heard from others. And later on, which would have been in the equivalent of high schools when I was 16, perhaps, I went to a first excavation which was in Flanders in a medieval monastery, and I got hooked there. Sort of, I went on to study classics. At school, it also picked up, but they were also offering Greek, so I did both ancient Greek and classics, archaeology, the Mediterranean, and so on from there. And I was initially sort of really the Iron Age, sort of pre-Roman period was something sort of that got me interested. So I wrote an undergraduate thesis on the Etruscan world. I excavated a lot in Etruria, and then looking for sort of PhD topics, so I spent a year in work at UCL in the anthropology department, sort of coming back to Leiden, the university in the Netherlands where I'd been an undergrad, then there was an opportunity to join a research project starting on Sardinia, and so that's where I went on.
Yeah, but that was a long time ago. So what has kept your interest on Sardinia after all of those years?
It's a very interesting context. It's not Italy. It's part of the modern state of Italy, but that's historical, happenstance in a way. Culturally, it's really part of the West Mediterranean, and it's sort of well off the radar of certainly Anglophone academia, and a little bit less so now, but certainly at the time. And so starting to work there, it's a fascinating island. It's a really large island. Sort of here, sort of tell students all this, 9 times the size of Rhode Island.
And it looks like there's some, this is purely my outsider's perspective on it, but it feels like there's a lot of really great archaeology there.
Yes. Yeah. It's very peripheral in the modern state, and peripheral, remote is the sort of the word, and that which makes it tough for people, to find work and to live there nowadays, and has for a long time, but that has sort of left a very good preservation of the archaeology around, which is in part is also something that I'm sure we'll get to talk about later, has left the nuraghi, which are anyway very monumental remains. So archaeology is anywhere. It it's one of those places where archaeology is really in your face, everywhere around, everywhere you go. It's all, and because of that, even nowadays, one of the remarkable things, archaeologists, as archaeology as a profession, is a very common profession. It's one of the few places where it's is surprised to hear you're an archaeologist. Of course, you'd come there. Everybody has an archaeologist in their family, sort of almost.
Well, that's incredible. Like, I had never really thought of the idea of archaeology being just like a common profession that's kind of wound its way into society more broadly.
Yeah, well, it's kind of, or has studied it, I should probably say, because professionally, finding employment is not easy there either. So it's, perhaps I should sort of rephrase that a little bit as, a lot of people trained as an archaeologist or sort of, and everybody knows the archaeology because it's literally in their backyards, in their fields and wherever. If you go to the beach, wonderful beaches, and then there's an Uraga there, sort of not very far from it. So the archaeology is really an integral part of the contemporary island. And that's at the moment, it's become really politicized as well. And so it's constantly in the newspapers as well.
That reminds me a lot of, I lived in Ireland for 2 years and I did some archaeology when I was there. I worked with some archaeologists, but it reminds me a lot of that in the sense that there are just tower houses and little castles and things like that. And it's just out in a farmer's field. And it's just something that you drive past as you're on your way to the market or you're on your way to school every day. But again, a very similar kind of thing where you have a rural landscape that is not as intensively utilized today as it has been in centuries past. And so these are obviously nowhere near as ancient as the Nuraghe are, but very kind of similar circumstances in the intervening centuries.
No, absolutely. And that's sort of, in a remarkable sense of, I've worked 15 years at the University of Glasgow. And so the Scottish Highlands have that same since the depopulation of the Highlands. The remains, if you go there, the archaeology is everywhere. And it has become with the stronger emphasis on regional identities. The archaeology has played an important part in that as well. So that made it really, that's the sort of my sort of fascination and interest with the island. But then sort of professionally, archaeologically for myself, so I've continued to do fieldwork on Sardinia all the time because in a way, on the one hand, sort of life's too short and you can only do a summer, a field season takes away much of a summer. And I find it impossible to run more than one project at a time. There are people who do it, and that's definitely possible, I guess. But that's been one. But at the same time, sort of more intellectually, academically, for me, it's been the entire West Mediterranean that's come into it. And so I've become very much involved in Spanish Iberian archaeology, not so much through direct fieldwork, but I've been visiting professor in Valencia, Palma de Mallorca, and I'm going to be next year in Barcelona. So sort of through those, I'm sort of really connected with people there, and I've been co-advising quite a number of grad students. So I've sort of, my fieldwork is in Sardinia, but my research is the sort of the entire West Mediterranean.
If you travel for work, you know to pack two suits, business and swim. You know with your Delta SkyMiles Business Amex card, buying that plane ticket for a business trip can get you closer to medallion status. You know that a meeting in Montana means visiting almost every national park.
Yellowstone? Check.
Because you're the chief excursion officer. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum Business American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Visit go.amex/business.
Do you ever wonder where all your money went? Like every single time you look at your bank account? Honestly, it's probably all those subscriptions. I felt that way too, until I got Rocket Money. Rocket Money helped me see all the subscriptions I'm paying for, and it was eye-opening. Between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it all adds up so quickly. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
You mentioned before that Sardinia is more part of the West Mediterranean, that it is part of the Italian milieu, despite the modern state boundaries that go along with it. what does Sardinia share in common with the West Mediterranean, especially in the early Iron Age, that it doesn't share in common with Italy? Like, what brings it closer together there?
Iron Age connection, sort of it's the sort of through the Phoenician connection in a way. But I want to immediately specify that because, well, say there's particularly the last 10 years, there's quite a bit of Iron Age Sardinian material that has turned up in North Africa and Andalusia. But that doesn't necessarily mean that it's all Phoenicians that have been bringing it there. Sort of that's something else, and that still needs sort of further qualification, I guess. But that's an ongoing research theme. So that's actually one of the really sort of interesting topics at the moment.
It's really fascinating that you mentioned that, because I did a couple of episodes on Phoenicians. And so I was reading through all of the really recent archaeological work that's been done at sites like Huelva and in the vicinity. And there's tons of like Sardinian pottery that's showing up in those sites, like a substantial amount.
Well, tons is...
tons is relative. Yeah,
it's handfuls of shirts. And there's now a large number of Phoenician style amphorae that have been ascribed to Sardinia. But again, that picture is being nuanced because those things have probably a whole range of production places, and it's not quite sure that it's all Sardinian. But it's absolutely true. Sort of in really from 10th century context in Huelva and later on at the Malaga airport, La Rebanadilla. So that's one of those really fascinating sites. And it's in Spain in particular. It's remarkable how much of that work is also in Spain associated with CRM, with commercial salvage excavations, where I have really at unexpected contexts, wonderful material has turned up.
Yeah, that's one of the cool things about archaeology in Europe that I don't think you see nearly as much with archaeology in the United States as those kinds of salvage excavations. And it's such a vibrant field there. There's so much work and there's so much happening in it. I don't know. It's very cool. It's a big difference.
No, absolutely. And the big difference with the US is that this is European legislation that's been adopted by and specified by all the European countries, and it applies to the entire country, whereas here NACPRA legislation applies only to federal land. And so that means there's an awful lot of land that's not protected.
So I want to shift gears a little bit. So we've been talking about Sardinia. Sardinia is a prime example of one of these places that falls outside what we usually see as the traditional centers of the ancient Mediterranean. So, I mean, you know, when we're thinking about the prime movers in that ancient world, it's usually ascribed to the Greeks, the Romans, maybe the Phoenicians. But how do those understandings, putting those people at the center of the Mediterranean, shape our understanding of it?
The Greeks and Romans, you mean sort of there? Well, that has really shaped everybody's understanding of Western civilization. It's sort of, you know, all the talk about democracy, American Revolution, that's being sort of directly traced back to 5th century Athens. That's a very linear teleological perception of the past. And that's now, not finally, that's been sort of called into question for quite a while, but sort of all those questions have, I think in recent years, have really come to a head and gained prominence and become really important questions. And suddenly, classics departments through the country are sort of grappling with it. And archaeologists, as a sense, sort of within that as well. And in its effect, if I'm allowed to mention that, there's a conference here that we're hosting at the Joukowsky Institute, which is about the state of the field about Mediterranean archaeology, precisely to think about, you know, what does the Mediterranean look like beyond the Greek and the Roman world?
Yeah, it strikes me that, like, the Mediterranean was just full of people, and our understanding of it is so distorted by a perspective that focuses on the Greeks and the Romans and even the Phoenicians to a certain extent, right? That just seeing them as the ones who were moving, seeing them as the ones who were bringing things to places and were setting up colonies or moving from place to place, that just tremendously distorts our picture of a much more dynamic and vibrant, complicated world.
Yeah, absolutely. It's, you know, usually the assumption is whenever you find Greek material somewhere that it's sort of Greeks who sort of navigated, you know, up down to that very beach and nearby and brought the stuff themselves. And then the pots and people debate has, you know, people have long realized, yeah, of course, it wasn't that simple. But still, the sort of idea that wherever you find that stuff, it was those people themselves who were getting there. And it's simply, the rest of many other peoples are just simply sort of written out of history or left out of history.
Yeah. So you mentioned that there were more people moving, that there's this assumption that it must have been Greeks or what have you who were taking this stuff there. I wanted to talk about you recently collaborated on a really interesting article about Sardinia, Sicily, Cyprus, and the prehistoric Mediterranean. And for a long time, there's been a tendency to ascribe these direct connections between those places. I was fascinated by the way that you and your co-authors wanted to scale back the discussion of mobility to what you call a more minimalist position. So what would a more minimalist position look like if you weren't looking for direct connections between those places? How would you think about it?
Well, I'm not sure we were calling ourselves minimalists in that sense, because the sort of maximalist-minimalist opposition has been coming from other work introduced particularly by Emma Blake earlier. And sort of my colleague Bernard Knapp and Anthony Russell, with whom we worked together at Glasgow years ago. So particularly Bernard and Anthony sort of posit that the minimalist position is that if you really try to quantify how much material is there, if you know that there's all these distribution maps of Mycenaean pottery across the West Mediterranean, once you start sort of putting it up, you really end up with, less than 1%. And it's sort of very, very small amounts of material that are there, or if you think about how much it sort of makes up of the entire context. So we were not so much trying to sort of pare things down to that sense, but really to complicate the transport sort of mechanisms, as it were, sort of trying, particularly there's the connections that are seen between Cyprus and Sardinia, which are, substantially apart in the Mediterranean. To say sort of, well, there's actually a lot of material that you also see moving, and which is, neuragic material. There's neuragic material. There's other Sicilian material that's associated. And where do we find that? And that doesn't get the same level of attention as the Mycenaean material. But looking at that and actually saying, well, there's a lot to be said that it's sort of even an old idea that the bulk of material will travel a short distance, and it's only so once the longest distance is the smallest quantity. That's the sort of Colin Renfrew and others were writing about in the 1970s, I think, sort of that sort of idea. The sort of the fall off the quantity with the distance. And once you start looking at it, then it also sort of makes it to the idea that there's a lot of societies, communities were traveling and sailing themselves as well. And presumably they had all the local knowledge about where can you safely beach your ship? How do you get past that dangerous cape with the currents? And, how do you get to the Strait of Messina, or how do you avoid it? That sort of thing. And so looking in this way, sort of these long distance connections seem a much, much more plausible. Particularly if you think back, and island of Sardinia, which is relatively remote in the West Mediterranean, but obsidian from the island of Sardinia, one of the large obsidian sources, has been exported since the 6th millennium. So it's not that people were not getting around in the West Mediterranean.
It's just that we have to understand better the mechanisms by which they did that. So rather than thinking in terms of these really long distance voyages and direct connections, you're looking for more localized networks that are then overlapping and intersecting with one another. So instead of going straight from Sardinia to Cyprus, you've got intermediate steps along the way, each of which is its own little world of small connections. Is that correct?
Precisely, more or less. And then even then you can, that's not what we wrote about, but you can visualize, you can imagine these sort of connections in multiple ways. You can think of cargoes that move and are being redistributed, and they're actually, and that was one of the arguments they were making, and what I've been making also for much more recent periods in the first millennium, that there are those connecting places, which in the more classical world tend to be called emporia, or emporia. But you can also think of that it actually might be one ship that makes the whole distance, but perhaps gets another crew, or gets a pilot on board, or all that sort of ways. And I think probably the answer, if you're trying to think, because we're also talking about a fairly long period, several centuries, in which this stuff gets distributed, all of the above must have played a role in those distributions.
Yeah, and it's interesting when you think about it in those terms, because that's a much more like realistic way of approaching the material that when you think about that really, really long distance mobility, which sure, that occurs. And you know, the evidence at this point for the Phoenician stuff seems to point to really pretty direct voyages across the entirety of the Mediterranean. But that doesn't mean that that's how everything worked. And it doesn't mean that that would have been a very specific subset of a more kind of a quotidian daily life type of mobility that brought people together over much shorter distances. It's like with migration, the concept of levee flights, right? That like the vast majority of your connections are very, very short in distance. When people move, they're going to move a few miles down the road. But then you also have a disproportionate number of really long distance voyages, really long distance trips. And so is trade functioning kind of similarly? Do we see the same kind of distribution there where just like a few things that move a very long way?
Well, you know, there's always those things that a few things that move a long way. But at some point, you start also saying it's more substantial. One of the fascinating sites, again, in the south of Spain is Cadiz, which until not so long ago, sort of there was nothing older than 6th century. And then again, through commercial work, there's now this sort of late 9th, early 8th century little neighborhood. It's a street with a couple of side streets and sort of houses, including two-story houses, where both architecture, portable material culture, the ovens, the flatbread ovens that people had, it's very Phoenician in lifestyle and every day. So that's a substantial number of people who moved and really built a small Phoenician-style house there, which is what makes that site very different from a place like Huelva or even La Rebanadilla or the early sites on Sardinia, which are in an indigenous context.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit more about that. What would indigenous Sardinian society have been like on the eve of it being integrated into a broader Mediterranean?
A Mediterranean connected, sophisticated in its own way society, sort of recognizably different than other parts, but still sort of a complex economy with, yeah, also metallurgy, various kinds of, you know, ceramic production, sort of, yeah, all that sort of things. And so very sort of varied. And also with it's the Bronze Age, Iron Age Sardinian society is known as nuragic, with reference to the term nurage, plural nuragi, which are these large stone towers that still dot the island. It's about 7,000 of them are on record on the whole island.
7,000?
Yes, but a large number of those are not more than a single ring of stones. But there are also some really, really large ones. And for instance, the one that I've been co-directing an excavation, that stands 4 or 5 meters tall and has another 2 meters underground, 60 meters across. And that's the sort of central monument itself and then sort of settlement around it.
So, I mean, those are huge. I highly recommend people listening to this look up pictures of them because they are really impressive structures. I mean, they are like, these are substantial. They're the megalithic monumental type of structures. And as you mentioned, there are a ton of them. So what are they doing? What's the function of them? Why build all of these things?
Again, a lot of, you know, this sort of, because of the impression that they make, the sort of comparison has always been made with castles. They've been called proto-castles and that sort of thing. And so, yeah, so defense is an element, and obviously that is. But there's also a wide variety. When I say those 7,000, the majority of those are just single towers. And, you know, just so that would still have been sort of 10 meters tall or something like that. But the sort of the larger ones are an agglomeration of multiple towers, and a smaller number even have then sort of an external defense wall. And so the ones that we're excavating had this wall with 10 towers in the wall itself, smaller towers. And yeah, so defense clearly was an element, but also just making an impression, sort of, you know, a statement of power and might sort of on an area. But at the same time, there were also places where people lived, and the smaller ones could have been, well, we don't know, extended families, sort of parts of kinship groups. The really big ones, they're clearly sort of elite elements at play also, because you got some really remarkable early imports there in the early first millennium, particularly in the Bronze Age, there seems to have been a little bit less contact. You get that both from the material culture, which is not to say there was no contact. That's not the case at all. But you get it from the material culture, and also recent genetic, archaeogenetic work has really demonstrated that there was remarkably little impact on the genetic makeup of the sort of Bronze Age up to the very early Iron Age population.
If you travel, you know how to pull off a perfect getaway. You know, after you enroll with your Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card, you get up to $10 back monthly on U.S. rideshare purchases with select providers, like a car to the airport. You know which remote retreats have the best herbal baths and where the Wi-Fi password is rarely used, because you're the escape artist. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Purchases must be on card. Visit go.amex/you know.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
For those of our listeners who don't know, Sardinia has some fantastic metal resources. It's incredibly rich in copper, which when we're talking about the Bronze Age, if you want to make bronze, you got to have copper. Sardinia is one of the prime sources for that. So Sardinia is exporting copper through the Bronze Age, right?
Well, that's one of those discussions, the connections with Cyprus in particular, because talking about islands and copper, Cyprus has even larger resources that are more prominently sort of, there is at Sardinia, there's very little evidence at the moment of ancient exploitation.
Really?
Which is partially also a function, must be a function of research and sort of relative inaccessibility of some of the mountains where you have those resources. But yeah, sort of, but metallurgy was always relatively well developed in the island throughout the Bronze Age and later. And yeah, there's clearly sort of in that time, there's metallurgical connections. There's also sort of, there's a famous Iron Age features. One of the famous Iron Age hallmarks are the small statuettes in bronze called bronzetti that are made with a lost wax method. And again, that must have been sort of an introduction sometime late Bronze Age, early Iron Age, sort of, that's sort of hard to pin down, but somewhere there.
Well, so that's fascinating because you have this island that is clearly connected to other places, but that has its own really distinctive local character that is consistent for a long time. Like the nuraghe are a really long lasting phenomenon, right? Like people are building these things for centuries and centuries and centuries.
Yeah, the traditional picture is that they're built throughout the Bronze Age, sort of up to the 12th century or so, and that then they're not or less built. But in fact, it is because of the size of these things, and also because they're really stone is really, well, you know, hard to date to do these things. So you need to find good context where you can get down to the foundations. And in a way, that sort of work has not been done very often. So the one that we've excavated, where we were able to find good evidence of the foundation, which is actually remarkably late, that is the very end of the 8th century. So it's way later than the normal ones. Although I should immediately say as well, what we have dated is the outer external wall, and we have no idea what's inside there. So that may well, and we need to assume until we should be able to demonstrate otherwise that that is older.
So, okay. So even if the bulk of them are being built earlier, though, they remained in use. They're persistent places in the landscape. They're a really defining feature of the society.
Absolutely. And that is the focus of the research project that I've been conducting with my colleague, Alfonso Stieglitz, from the museum in San Viromilis in Provincia di Oristano. For 10 years now. And so we've moved away from the nuraghe in the Bronze Age. So we say we're going to look at the nuraghe in the first millennium. And you know, it's one of those sort of interesting things where nuraghe are seen as prehistoric monuments. So prehistorians excavate them. First millennium, by then, that's Phoenician and sort of, you know, classical between inverted commas period. So that's what classicists do. And so as a Phoenician Roman archaeology, you don't go and excavate the Nuraga because that's a prehistoric monument. And although people have long known that there are those later occurrences, but no one was really working on it systematically. There's one excavation where, again, through a sort of a salvage intervention, where early, well, so first millennium Greek material, some of the earliest Greek material was found. It's Nuraga of Santimbenia in the north. But now, and so that one, and now sort of at Suraki and another one, Nuraga Sirai in the south, those are now the three Nuragi in which there's been substantial excavation outside the Nuraga and where extensive settlements with very substantial contexts have been documented, but also different types of architecture. So it's not just that the architecture, the Nuragic sort of round houses continue to be occupied because those had been, you know, documented earlier and elsewhere as well. But it's really where there's very sort of extensive engagement with the outside world, and you see cultural change happening. And we see that at Suraki is what we get from the 5th century. We're now excavating Phoenician-style houses, mud brick houses, square, probably even a second story, that are 50 meters from the Nuraga. So you get these really impressive views of these sort of Middle Eastern-style houses, and then a really large Nuraga right next to it.
Well, that's an incredible kind of, in a nutshell, the idea of connectivity in the Mediterranean, right? Is that it's not that you have one group of people who are going in and imposing like a whole new way of doing things or a whole new landscape. It's not like the previous people disappeared. It's not like their monuments disappeared. So you end up with these like interesting hybridized landscapes, hybridized cultures that go along with them.
No, absolutely. And that has been the sort of the goal of our project as well. And it's also, I think, a great demonstration of how you see, you know, until you look for it, it's hard to say whether it's there or not there. And so if you're trying to, for a long time, you know, I have been part of that as well, sort of in the beginning, if you're trying to understand Phoenician or Greek colonization and you only excavate Greek colonies or Phoenician foundations, Phoenician settlements, then of course you're going to have the impression that everything becomes Phoenician or Greek. But it's only until you start excavating settlements that, say, are a kilometer or 10 kilometers away. And at Suraki, we're 15 kilometers outside the Phoenician foundation of Taros, which becomes from the 7th century sort of a big settlement. And it's only then that you start seeing all those variations and sort of interactions become more in focus.
So let's talk a little bit more about Sardinia and its interaction with the Mediterranean. How do things change on Sardinia when Phoenicians start showing up, when Sardinia becomes more integrated into the wider Mediterranean, like when the scale and density of those connections becomes greater?
It's the first couple of centuries of the first millennium are really interesting. There's still a fair bit of chronological confusion, which has to do with the chronological discrepancy I think you've talked about before in other interviews. That sort of geometric pottery and radiocarbon datings, that, and then the sort of the Hallstatt uncertainty of the 8th century and later. So that plays into here as well. But there's changes in Nuragic society that are already happening, that's starting at the end of the second millennium, and that really sort of come to a head, say, from the 9th century onwards or so. And that you start seeing in a big way. It's around that time that Phoenicians start appearing, but we find them in Sardinia as really the very end of the 9th century in an indigenous context. So, and there's been some sort of anxiety among Sardinian archaeologists or in Sardinia. If you think back of what I was saying at the beginning about the sort of the interest and the political interest and modern identities, that whether those changes were all sort of imposed or precipitated by foreigners coming. And I think that's too simplistic to put it that, or it was a purely Nuragic development, or it was purely Phoenicians who brought change. It's neither of them or both of them.
Well, that's really interesting, because that speaks a lot to the same kinds of discussions that people have been having about the chronology of change in central Italy as well, you know, so not too far distant from Sardinia, but the questions of the changes that you're seeing in those societies at those times, are those driven by contact with the outside world? Are they imposed by contact with the outside world? Or, I mean, the thing that strikes me, though, is that it seems like when you look at the chronology, these changes are already in process when Phoenicians and Greeks start to show up there. It's almost like they are pulled to these places by the fact that they're becoming more interesting. There are more things that they would want there. There's more that you can do with those contacts.
No, no, precisely. And so if it, yeah, as you, or exactly as you say, if there weren't interesting things going on, and if you can't see metal resources from a distance if you're out on the sea. So if local people had not already brought those things to attention, nobody would know that those things are there. But at the same time, yes, of course, Phoenicians are coming in, or Greeks or others, with new means, also with new knowledge about other places. And of course, all of those things sort of work together. But you also see changes. We've been, you know, one of the really interesting is those sort of round bread ovens, those tanurs that I already mentioned for Cadiz in the 9th century. So the oldest one in Sardinia, I'm not quite sure, but we're probably looking at a definitely 7th, 6th century ones there, but they may be early, probably earlier as well. And you find these things then sort of way down to the 2nd century. So these become really integrated. And so, yeah, those people start changing and making a different kind of bread. So these are every changes in everyday life. But at the same time, that doesn't mean that people no longer are Sardinian or Neretic or whatever you would want to call them.
Well, it's so funny that you mentioned the bread ovens, because I saw a wonderful video today, a Cajun guy in Louisiana building a homemade tandoor. So the guy is obsessed with naan. He really wants to make naan, but he lives in what looks like pretty rural Louisiana, right? So he builds a homemade oven, and he's got the bricks in there, and he's got quick dry cement, and he's got a nice terracotta thing that he can put slap the naan on to cook. But like, this is not going to change the fact that this guy is speaking with a thick Cajun accent. He clearly, again, is clearly living in Louisiana, but he just really wants the naan. And I feel like that's such a pure and wonderful example of the kind of cultural contact that we're seeing in the period that you're talking about, where people see something that they like. It's practical. It food that tastes good, tastes maybe a little bit different than what they're used to. And then it just becomes, you know, two generations from now, after this guy has built his homemade tandoor, who's going to know where it came from or where he got the idea? It's just part of the fabric of your world.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And that's, I think that's what makes that whole period sort of really so interesting. And it is in places as Sardinia, but also in Iberia. And it's perhaps sort of easier to follow or more visible some of these processes because the preservation of the archaeological record is pretty good, but also because there's perhaps sort of starker differences between the kinds of material that makes it a little bit easier to see those things.
Late nights at work taking a toll on your skin? Do you find yourself staring at those dark circles in the mirror? Well, it's time to meet your new best friend, Dark Circle Defense Balm from Lumen. Lumen is a line of brilliant men's skincare solutions crafted especially for men who want to look and feel their brightest. Whether you're a seasoned skincare pro or a total newbie, Lumen Skin has got you covered. Lumen's Dark Circle Defense Balm is a lightweight gel that absorbs seamlessly into your skin to brighten your under eyes and instantly plump dehydration lines. It's basically an espresso shot for your eyes. The best part? Lumen will let listeners of this podcast try the product out for free. Yes, you heard that right. Free. Head to lumenskin.com/wondery and get your free trial of Dark Circle Defense and their other amazing products now. Say goodbye to tired-looking eyes and say hello to a new and refreshed you. Don't wait any longer. Your skin will thank you. That's lumenskin.com/wondery for your free trial.
One of your specialties is rural archaeology. How do we define rural archaeology? How do you actually go about doing it, as opposed to kind of more like deep stratigraphic excavation or like urban archaeology? What makes rural archaeology different, and how do you actually go about doing it?
Well, so as you say, sort of it's not concentrated in one place. You know, sort of as big cities, they, you know, certainly in the Mediterranean, we know what the major settlements are or were. We're talking about centuries of archaeological sort of research, exploration, and all of that. So rural sites is sort of very, you know, that's the sort of occupation that and the rest of the region, the rest of the area. And defining rural, that's even today still a tricky thing. But I think, and it's also rural occupation, it doesn't have to be just farms. That's the most, you know, and I think rural archaeology has become a big thing in archaeology since the 1970s, with when survey became really big, and they're finding all these small scatters of shirts and that they're all turned to farm sites. And still the numbers of sites that of those sites that have been excavated is very, very small. Even the Roman archaeology, sort of where you think there's just not many of those have been excavated. And so, and that in a sense, that's what I found really interesting. Plus what you began also so by saying, what I've been interested in is sort of the other Mediterranean, which is other in terms of indigenous, and but also indigeneity is not the only axis of difference, of otherness. Class, to use a more sort of old-fashioned term, is one of that that sits right up there as well. And I think the rural side is an important part. Plus, and then that's this is a really important part, I think, for understanding colonialism or ancient rural economy. We're talking about pre-capitalist societies in which the main economic activity was agrarian. So unless and until we go out there, and I mean out in all that regional area, and see what is there, try to investigate sort of how people were living, but also how they were doing, how they were working the field. You can, there's an understand, there's a sort of idea, oh, it's not interesting. Well, and then it depends on, you know, what is interesting, because yeah, they were not doing many wall paintings or many producing statues or so. If that's your definition of interesting, yeah, then it's true. But if you're interesting, your definition of interesting is economic production. What are they growing? Is it cash crops? Is it sort of just self-sufficiency? Then you should not go to the cities, but should look at those places.
I grew up in a rural area, and I think it's very common for people who are not familiar with that kind of lifestyle to assume that it's simple, or to assume that people are subsistence farmers, or, you know, to use more pejoratively, that they're dirt farmers of some kind. But like, rural areas can be incredibly sophisticated and can have incredibly sophisticated exchange economies of their own. Like the area that I grew up in is all about commercial agriculture. But if you don't know anything about rural areas and you don't know anything about agriculture, you're just going to go through and you're going to see fields and orchards and things like that. You're not going to be able to understand the kind of sophisticated economic basis of that, the distribution networks for that produce and how far they reach. Like, this is a kind of, I mean, it's a sophisticated part of a modern economy that just happens to be rural. And there's no reason why ancient rural economies were necessarily any different. I mean, sure, there are subsistence economies as well, but you can't just assume that people are entirely self-sufficient and doing things for themselves.
No, precisely. And that is, yeah. And you know, as you say, yes, yeah, sophisticated. And it was at that time was just as sophisticated as the area. And then again, you start seeing the difference. So it's not just all rural. It's actually in some areas where there are cash crops and other areas where it's sort of people don't live in farms, but they live in villages. And, you know, and going back to that Sardinian situation, as our big nuraghi, you could actually see, which began in the sort of early first millennium, sort of has elite connotations, is a big thing, has public places. It becomes sort of ruralized through the centuries. And when we got to the second century, there's just a bunch of single room houses that are backed up against the defensive wall, using it. And so, yeah, it seems like you could call it impoverished. And I'm not sure that is the right term, but it's no longer this sort of a thriving center that it was sort of, but you know, that's 600-800 years before. So things do change in that time span.
Yeah. And that's also important to, it's important to have that dimension as well, right? That you talk about, like whether we think about it in terms of impoverishment or ruralization, that things can reach in that direction and they don't always get more urbanized and more centralized and more connected. It's possible for places to fall out of the networks or for population density to fall. I mean, I think that's in a lot of places, that's really hard for people to grasp in the 21st century, where we're used to there always being more people, more, 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 and more. And over long enough historical timeframes, that's not always how things work.
No, and precisely, well, and I think that's the fascinating thing of archaeology, where you have that time depth. And particularly, I think also sort of working across conventional boundaries, that's sort of perhaps almost another dimension of otherness, is sort of what, that's again what I find fascinating of that first millennium, starting the Iron Age, sort of prehistoric conventionally, and then moving right up to the Roman Republican period, the period post the Punic Wars, which are almost as classical as some of those topics get. And yeah, those things and places are all connected, and you see continuities sort of over those centuries, although at the same time, things change incredibly.
Yeah, I love the idea of a Mediterranean and an ancient world that's full of multitudes, that is comprised of local societies, because most people's lives are local. Like, we've talked a lot about mobility and connectivity, and that's almost to the extent that it's become the dominant paradigm for talking about the ancient Mediterranean, which is great. Like, it's fantastic that we see those connections in ways that we didn't before, but it's almost like the local sometimes gets left out of that. The local gets forgotten, or the interface between the local and the larger context.
Yeah, precisely. And I think there's also sort of intellectually a really interesting discussion to be had about when do we start using local and no longer the term indigenous? And how does that, and that sort of changes as well, sort of how long, because that sort of seems as indigeneity. And that's something that you can also look at the American, North American past. Sort of indigeneity in the 20th century is now has become a really big thing again. But for a long time this century, it was Native Americans were supposed to have disappeared from urban centers. And that's now, there's wonderful research being done again that shows that that's definitely not the case.
You can imagine, if you're thinking of Sardinia, right, in the context of being a part of a broader Mediterranean, or whether it's a Punic world or a Roman world, that local identity can be more or less important at different points and different times in that process, and can be emphasized in different ways.
Yeah, precisely. Well, and also sort of who gets to become or to be local? Because if you think Phoenician and then Carthaginian, a couple of hundred years later, so yeah, there's it is no longer just a binary. There's different groups, or have some of those sort of, or previously colonial groups, have they become indigenous in the meantime? How does that work? Would it have been seen by people like that, or is that just us looking at it in those ways? Yeah, it's all, those are very complex matters, and archaeology, because of the time depth that we have, particularly in the Mediterranean, makes it a little bit easier to look at these things.
So, by way of kind of wrapping things up here, because we've talked about so much cool stuff, you are actively excavating there. You're collaborating on archaeoscientific work, on ADNA work, and isotopic studies. As you're looking at the future of your field, and you're thinking about, you've got a really interesting perspective, because it's very rooted in Sardinia. Like, you've done so much specific work there, but like, you're also very interested in the wider Mediterranean, these broader trends within the field. What is most interesting to you? Where do you want to see Mediterranean archaeology, study of Sardinia? Where do you want to see these things go? What kind of work do you want to do?
Well, those are not necessarily the same, of course. So
No, not at all.
No, but there's various ways. And I think, interestingly, there's still parts of the Mediterranean in geographical terms that are, you know, in the whole of North Africa, there's one, two now probably Iron Age excavations. That's there's a lot to be done there. And so outside Egypt, I should say, North Africa. And so that is, that's obviously not helped by the political situations in Libya and Algeria, of course. But still, there's a lot of interesting work to be done. Later periods, there are still what's here in the Anglophone American world known as historical archaeology, this sort of much more recent post-medieval period. There is an archaeologia post-medievale in Italy that's reasonably well developed, but it doesn't have that breadth of development as it has here. So those later periods are really interesting. Contemporary, near-contemporary archaeology of the fascist period has been done a little bit. But it's also more, yeah, with the new technological means, there's interest. But at the same time, more sort of working with local communities and their interests and looking at it, which, you know, can be very different as well. And I think, yeah, and I think sort of what I'm really interested in is, as I said, sort of North Africa that fits in there, but also the on the rural side. And one of the things, for instance, that has had little attention is, again, migration and trade are usually seen as, if not elite, then at least elite-sponsored activities, or, you know, although nobody would claim that the sailors themselves were elites, but it's sort of the movers and shakers in those things, activities, it's all channeled through major port cities. And I think there is, if you start looking really well at rural contexts in different places, you start seeing connections directly between those rural areas. And once you then start thinking of in more historical periods, in seasonal work, people were moving, and those were rural communities or, usually the young males of the rural communities directly moving to other areas, moving back and forth, some of them staying there for all sorts of reasons and creating connections that are separate from the sort of formal connections that go between the major city-states. And it's kind of an alternative network across the Mediterranean. That's, I think, some really interesting topic to be explored.
Oh, God, you're speaking my language directly. I am fascinated by that kind of mobility that is very rarely mentioned in written sources, right? It's something because it pertains to a part of the population that is either illiterate or whose writing almost never survives. I mean, you see tiny little pieces of those social groups from the Roman period, but even then, they're not exactly heavily represented in the epigraphic corpus. But it's a kind of mobility that you know had to have happened, and it happened all the time. It pertained to a much broader segment of society than elite merchants or even like specialized travelers like sailors. But it's hugely important to making kind of local and regional worlds and to disseminating. I mean, you think about the linguistic map of the Mediterranean and how do dialects meld into one another. It's precisely that kind of mobility and contact that makes those dialect maps happen. It's not one ship showing up every season.
No, precisely. Absolutely. And there were a great fascinating example of that is the connections between southern Sicily, so particularly southwest Sicily and Tunisia, that are now being used by smugglers, people smugglers that are, gangs, so-called, sort of, that are exploiting migrants wanting to cross into Europe. Those are continuing connections that tuna fishermen, connections between the two shores that go back centuries and possibly even longer. And it's really fascinating to see that there's a little bit work that's starting to be done there. And that's really fascinating.
Oh, gosh. Well, I cannot wait to see where your work takes you, Professor. Thank you so much for your time. It's an absolute pleasure. And again, thank you.
No, thank you very much. This was a really wonderful conversation as well. And it's been a pleasure hearing quite a few of your other broadcasts. So I'm happy to have been able to contribute to those as well. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Professor. Thank you for your time.
Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Tides of History ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
Thanks so much for joining me today. Be sure and hit me up if you'd like to chat about anything we've talked about on Tides or something you'd like to see. You can find me on Twitter at Patrick_Wyman or on Facebook at @PatrickWymanMMA or on Instagram at @Wyman_Patrick. I write on other topics at patrickwyman.substack.com. Tides of History is written and narrated by me, Patrick Wyman. The sound engineer is Sergio Enriquez. Tides of History is produced by Morgan Jaffe. From Wondery, the executive producers are Jenny Lower Beckman and Marshall Louie.
Let's jump into Peppa's world of play. Look for spring flowers, hunt for muddy puddles, and bravely explore exciting places with Peppa play sets. Peppa Pig, inspiring kid confidence.